from the Sirius Report. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Tom, it's an absolute pleasure as always.
So, Paul, obviously there's a mountain of things to try and understand about the war right now. We are seemingly, we're recording this on Monday, April 13th, which is just after the peace talks have supposedly almost, a resolution was almost reached, and supposedly right at the last second, they backed away from it. So where are we as an overall, let's say, summary of the war right now?
Yeah, we have to be a bit careful with this. we could talk for many hours about it, but in essence, from day one, without going through every single development, the idea that killing the supreme leader Ali Khamenei was going to end the war instantly was an extremely stupid idea, and it was going to have the exact opposite effect. And they should have woken up to the reality that he wasn't in some bunker hidden in the middle of nowhere in Iran. He was in his house. He wasn't trying to hide. And therefore, they should have asked the question, well, if he's not trying to hide, what's his objective here? And it was very clear his objective was to make what you might term a supreme sacrifice, because he knew quite clearly it would galvanize the Iranian people around the government, around the IRGC, etc. Now, you know, if someone like me can know this and understand this, then the US military, US intelligence, etc. should have known this as well. And clearly they didn't. They didn't have any clue whatsoever. Then, of course, the issue became, and it's a bit of a grey area as to who actually started the war. Was it the Israelis or was it the Americans? Seems as though it was the Americans 5 seconds after the Israelis launched this preemptive strike on targets in Tehran. And then we sort of go through this whole process that's been going on for, you know, over 6 weeks now, when nobody on the American side thought the war would last more than 6 days. And I think there was a lot of assurances given by the Israeli intelligence and elements in the US intelligence that were completely incorrect, and they totally underestimated Iran's capabilities, both defensively and offensively. And we've heard all manner of ridiculous stories coming out from Trump himself and the Trump administration claiming that they have achieved all their objectives and Iran is being destroyed militarily. And yet, for some strange reason, Iran seems to be able to respond with offensive and defensive capabilities, which completely contradicts the narrative, which we know, of course, is simply untrue. So in a very broad sense, if we look at what the US's objectives were, they wanted regime change. Well, they haven't got regime change. Yes, they may have killed Ali Khamenei, but they've replaced him with his son, who is more of a hardliner. And of course, the irony in that is that he always had a fatwa that said, we will never produce nuclear weapons. Now, the question is, has he disposed of that fatwa and therefore now Iran is in a position to potentially manufacture nuclear weapons, even though they've said they never would do? Well, that's something we're not sure of at this point in time. But that doesn't constitute achieving an objective. The other thing, of course, is it's made the IRGC stronger in my eyes than it ever has been in the whole time since 1979. So that is a total abject failure. The US has not destroyed their ballistic missile capability or their drone capability or their defensive capabilities either. They haven't seized the enriched uranium, and we should probably come on to that as a failed initiative or a failed operation on the US side. They haven't restricted their nuclear capability or impacted their nuclear program in any way, shape or form. There was talk that they were going to destroy all these underground cities, but they haven't even attacked a single underground city, not least because they're in the east of Iran and they can't reach them as targets. Because the other thing the US has claimed, we control Iranian airspace. Well, if that is true, why is most attacks, and there have been substantial amounts of attacks on particularly Tehran, but they're all using standoff weapons, meaning we're firing weapons outside of Iran to strike targets inside. Why? Because they don't want to infiltrate Iranian airspace, because when they do, things like F-15s get shot out the sky, as one example. And they've had to say, well, they've got no defensive capabilities, and then the next breath having to admit something like an F-15's being shot out the sky. Well, you know, that's clearly a massive contradiction in terms. Things like, we've destroyed their navy. Well, with all due respect, Iran doesn't really have a navy as we would envisage a navy to exist. So that wasn't true either. So you can go on and on, but you get the point that all these objectives the US had have failed to materialize. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the question now that's starting to be asked increasingly is, well, how much offensive capability has Iran got left, vis-a-vis the fact that it's very obvious that the defensive capabilities of Israel and the United States is virtually nothing now. They've got very little capability to intercept anything, because, of course, what the Iranians did was did a lot of drone saturation, which meant particularly the Israelis fired off a lot of interceptor missiles and didn't even need to do so, because a lot of them were just decoys. But it achieved an objective from Iran's perspective. So again, that's a total contradiction from the official narrative with regards to the war. So therefore, it's not also the capability of Iran to defend itself, which it to a significant extent has done so. Now, someone who I regard as reliable has recently come back from Iran and said to me, yes, there's damage irrefutably, but the damage is not as severe as the West or the United States or Western media, etc., is trying to make out. They haven't struck as many targets as we were led to believe, which again implies that the Iranians' defensive capability is stronger, you know, than conventional wisdom would have us believe. So you start to look at this whole pattern through the entire war, and the United States, of course, is now in this very serious position of trying to find an off-ramp, trying to find a way to say we've achieved our objectives and we've won the war, even though, of course, the United States could leave the theater of conflict anytime it likes. But if Iran keeps fighting the war, it looks rather ridiculous to say we've won the war and achieved our objectives when Iran carries on apparently fighting the war. The other thing, of course, is the whole Strait of Hormuz, which no one controlled it before the war started. And, okay, there's an argument about this blockade that's enforced any moment now, or might have already been done so, where the US is claiming they're going to prevent Iranian vessels leaving the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz, of course. But during the course of the war, the Iranians, to the Americans' embarrassment, is now controlling it, including charging toll fees payable in the yuan, which is just even more humiliating for the Americans, given clearly it's not in dollars. The whole story about the petro yuan, etc., is probably something we'll park for the financial stuff, because whilst it's true, it has to a large extent been grossly exaggerated for effect more than anything. But this is another example where the Iranians have had control now of the Strait of Hormuz when they didn't before the war started. So in fact, that's a strategic advantage for the Iranians, given it's the most important waterway in the world because of the huge amounts of not least oil and gas that's obviously shipped through there on a daily basis. So with regards to an off-ramp for the United States, they had to find a way to say, well, we have to get out of this war and make it look like we won. And the rationale for the Trump administration is, well, there's midterms coming up in November, and if we lose the midterms, which is likely at this point in time, and if they lose the House and the Senate, the argument is Trump will be impeached, and if Trump's impeached, he ceases to be president. So they're trying to desperately scramble to find a way of an off-ramp that they can then somehow sell to the American people, who'll forget all the nonsense that has been said to them since the war started, and then Trump can somehow salvage, you know, victory from the jaws of defeat in terms of these midterms and miraculously win. I think it's completely ridiculous to think that's a given. In fact, I think it's probably unlikely. But, you know, I'm not the American electorate, so I'm not going to try and second guess how people might perceive a future, in inverted commas, US victory. So one of the very key points the US made from day one was things like, well, we're going to end their nuclear program. And they, like we said, we're going to seize their enriched uranium, of which there's probably nearly 500 kilos of it enriched to about 60%. So it's very clear, and they tried to make out that the operation was to recover this colonel who was in an F-15 that crashed. But the reality is, I'm not saying there wasn't a mission to try and rescue this colonel, although people are now starting to say what really happened in that regard, but I'm not here to speculate in with respect to things like that. It's very important from his perspective, clearly his family's perspective from the US military, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not something relevant to the discussion, except that it seems like it was a cover story for the fact that they had this operation in Isfahan, which is one of the nuclear facilities are that, of course, they claim to have destroyed in June last year in the 12-day war, which clearly at the time we said was nonsense, and they didn't. Well, they didn't. But apparently they've destroyed facilities again this time around in this war. But of course, that's not true either. But the mission was to go in and seize this enriched uranium. It completely failed because the Iranians have Chinese technology, which effectively allows them persistent surveillance within the entire landmass of Iran and up to 1,000 kilometers outside Iran. So they clearly tracked the C-130s, etc., that were landing in near Isfahan, near the nuclear facility. They allowed them in, then they attacked them. Then there's a whole story that the US had to exit and destroy what was left of these craft because they obviously didn't want them getting into the hands of the Iranians intact, but of course they were largely destroyed anyway. And that was clearly a strategic failure of biblical proportions for the US and a successful military operation from the Iranian perspective. So the off-ramp failed, meaning we can sit there with, and even if it wasn't true, they could show all these cylinders going, this is full of enriched uranium. We went into Iran, seized it. We've now stopped their nuclear capability. We've won the war, and we could all end the war, and I could still get my Nobel Peace Prize, and we can all go home and claim victory. Of course, because that didn't happen, the off-ramp was vaporized. So then we come back to this very peculiar situation where there was a ceasefire agreed, but that was only because of Chinese intervention. I think the Iranians said there's no point in having it because, bear in mind, we've had these talks before, and the last two times we had talks, we immediately had the 12-day war in June of 2025, and then we had the war starting on February the 28th, the day after there was discussions in Oman about trying to prevent a war and have a peace agreement. And therefore, the Chinese persuaded them, presumably with some sort of security guarantee, although at this point it's not exactly clear what that means. But it being what it is, they had these discussions. There was claims that they had broadly reached an agreement. Surprise, surprise, at the ninth hour, they all fell apart. Vance went home. They said they talked for 21 hours. There's all sorts of stories coming out about what was not agreed upon. And apparently Vance was permanently on the phone to Trump and claims he spoke to Netanyahu. We can't verify at this point in time any of this. But unsurprisingly, and it shouldn't really shock anybody, Iran and the United States are as far apart in terms of how they think this war should end as they can be. You know, it is sort of rather like the war between Russia and Ukraine, which has now gone on for over 4 years. And how many times have they had these discussions and it's just come, you know, come to nothing? Well, that's exactly what's happened. And it's principally, as much as anything, around saying we are going to keep our enriched uranium, we're going to have our, you know, nuclear program, and that isn't up for discussion. Rather like the idea that Iran should surrender all its ballistic missiles, so if there's another war in the future, it can't defend itself or be offensive either, for that matter. So in a very 30,000 foot way, and that's taken whatever how long it's taken to explain, that's currently where we are. There still has to be an off-ramp. There's still a need for the United States to get out of this as soon as possible. But then, of course, there's all the financial economic implications of this war carrying on much longer, as we're going to get into shortly.
Well, you know, I was going to say that I feel like we need to be able to understand what the actual, what the aims of the U.S. is in this conflict, right? Instead of trying to infer them from or assume what they are, it would be much more helpful to actually explicitly know what they are, right?
Absolutely. And the problem is they didn't have any of, well, let's take a little step back a few weeks to when there was clearly a color revolution attempt in Iran, and that was all to, again, overthrow the Iranian government, likely to overthrow the Ayatollah, who was subsequently obviously killed, Ali Khamenei, to decapitate the IRGC, etc. And then the Americans could put in a Western sympathetic, you know, governmental structure, including the president. Mm-hmm. I think that was very clearly the objective. And the color revolution failed miserably. And then they've come back and gone, well, we'd rather avoid any sort of proper military confrontation. So we'll have another bite at this by thinking, well, if we assassinate or kill Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, that will achieve the same objective. It will destabilize the government. The people will overthrow the government and we'll kind of achieve a color revolution that way, rather than putting protesters into the country and trying to stir up, you know, internal political, economic, whatever conflict. So, of course, that would seem to be the end of their objectives. After that, there was no plan. I mean, they were just then just this crisis management, just throwing the proverbial at a wall, hoping something would stick, and actually finding out clearly that was not succeeding. So therefore they started to introduce all these other statements about, you know, to do with enriched uranium. I'm not saying there wasn't some element of truth to that previously, but you know, that was something that had been going on ever since the days of the JCPOA, which Trump of course very stupidly walked away from during Trump 1.0. So there were kind of clearly elements to that as well. And then they started to make other statements but this was kind of just part of this high octane rhetoric language that Trump was coming out of and then seemingly backing away from 5 minutes later, and then coming back, you know, doubling down on the original statement. And everyone sat there not having a clue what's going on, not least, you know, the US's own allies. And clearly there was no support from the European NATO countries, who didn't want to get involved in an offensive capacity in a country that's not anything to do with NATO. So I think that's been part of the problem. The US doesn't have an objective other than regime change, and thinking that somehow then we'll be able to have control over Iran, and therefore we can control Iran's enormous energy reserves, its oil and gas. And of course, I know people are trying to link everything to China, and China is a common theme, although in the case of Venezuela, China only bought Venezuelan oil to settle the debt around Venezuela had with China. It largely used to sell that into the market at a profit because it was buying it a lot cheaper as per the agreement with Venezuela. But there is an element for sure that the United States, it knows it can't win a war with China, it can't defeat them economically or financially or technologically, so maybe we can cause them some damage by preventing them being able to access energy from the likes of Iran. But of course, forgetting that China can have as much energy as it wants from Russia anytime, whether it's today, tomorrow, next month, next year, or in 20 years' time, it's not a problem. So again, just a total miscalculation. But no, there is no objective. There is no plan. I mean, they're just crisis managing the need for an off-ramp because politically there is enormous pressure on the Trump administration by saying, well, you gave us assurances the war would be over very quickly. The military is extremely unhappy. The intelligence agencies are very unhappy. And of course, there's the big threat that if this war carries on, and obviously then, with, you know, there's all the economic financial considerations, that Trump's, you know, a lame duck president at best come the midterm, or ceases to be the president full stop, which you can't rule out, but only in the case of him losing the House and the Senate. But I think if that happens, he won't survive as president. He will be impeached. And therefore, there's enormous amounts of consternation in that regard. And there's no doubt there are certainly elements within Trump's own administration who just have no idea what's going on with regards to Trump's thinking, what he's saying one minute and then changing his mind the next. And there's no one to counterbalance what he's saying, because everybody knows if you started challenging Trump, you're probably going to be fired from his administration. So this is a very, very difficult internal matter as well. But they clearly need the off-ramp, and therefore they're having to, as they go along, invent, well, this was part of our objective, so let's shoehorn this objective in, and if it succeeds, we can get out of this war. But coming out with all these statements, we've destroyed their navy. No, you didn't. We've destroyed their missile and ballistic capabilities, offensively, defensively. No, you haven't, and the list goes on. They've achieved, as we said earlier, none of these objectives. But they're desperate to convince particularly the American people that indeed this is true. But practically everyone, including US NATO allies, in inverted commas, or should we say vassal states, all know this is just utter nonsense.
I want to go back to what you were saying about China, you know, being able to have as much energy from Russia anytime as they need or want. How, you know, at this point, we know that they import so much of their energy and their oil. How important is that Iranian energy to them? And is that, I guess, a piece that of the analysis that people are missing in the let's say the leverage over the rest of the world?
For sure. Look, I mean, it's historically known that China was, because of all the sanctions, was importing roughly 90% or 80% of Iran's exports, and they were doing it in such a way to avoid sanctions by these exports going to the so-called teapot refiners in China, and by this very convoluted means to hide, you know, the true intentions of what was going on, so they'd evade sanctions. The bigger question for China is not just how much Iranian oil they get, but what oil and other energy are they getting out the entire, you know, Middle East? What's going through the Persian Gulf? You know, this comes back to all, you know, how much do they get from Saudi? And there's no doubt Saudi Arabia's increased its oil exports to the broader Southeast Asia, ironically at the expense of the likes of the United States, which, as things stand, this poses an interesting question. To what extent, clearly, it is going to impact the Chinese, but they are circumventing some of those problems, not least because they have enormous strategic reserves, and they've been stockpiling oil for, to my knowledge, 3-4 years. They keep building storage capacity. It could be as much as at least 2 billion barrels. It may be 2.5 billion. It could even be higher. So they're okay for now. Yeah, they can get additional oil from Russia, for example. It's not a huge problem. If the war carries on, then clearly at some point it's going to become a significant problem. With regards to the United States, of course, everyone focuses on and this big claim, the United States is the biggest oil producer in the world. I think that's to a large extent probably true, but what people don't realize is if you look at the actual official, not the official data, but you read between the lines and look at the data, the United States is still a net importer of oil. So it exports a lot of this light sweet crude, but it needs a lot of heavy oil for things like diesel, jet fuel, bunker fuel, etc. So the United States, yeah, does have problems in this regard. And if people don't believe that, ask the question, why is the United States constantly trying to suppress the oil price? If they were just an exporter and the imports didn't matter, they'd be very happy for the oil price to be spiking because, rather like the Russians now, they're making huge additional profits because the oil price is so much higher. It doesn't work for the Americans in that regard, hence why they're desperate to suppress the price of oil, because if they don't, then obviously if oil stays, above $100 a barrel and continues to rise, and frankly, from my perspective, and this is not investment advice in any way, shape, or form, but oil for me should be at least, ignoring paper prices, $150 a barrel. Now, I'm not saying that this is unique to the United States, because it isn't, because Europe would be in exactly the same position as would the UK. But if oil was $150 a barrel, the United States economy would be in serious trouble, and as would the Western financial system, because there's no doubt the derivatives markets would be under serious duress if that was indeed the case. So I think this is this situation where, in terms of financialization, we've seen price manipulation. So the paper prices, well, this is what it looks like the price of oil is. In reality, if you want to go out and buy oil, it's considerably higher, which is why, whereas just a very simple example of this, when India used to buy Russian oil during the Ukraine war, they were getting it at quite a significant discount. They're now having to buy it at a premium to Urals crude price simply because of the global demand and the shortages, because, obviously, as we know, oil and even to that extent LNG is not getting shipped out of the region because of the ongoing war and obviously policy initiatives the Iranians have got in place with regards to the Strait of Hormuz. But it's not entirely the problem, but it's a significant proportion of the problem. And therefore, this energy situation that's now unfolding in the world is not just how it's going to impact Southeast Asia and China, but it's going to impact the entire world to varying degrees. The one nation who's sitting there, ironically, untouched by this is the Russians, because it's not affecting Russian energy production, it's not affecting Russia's capability to export oil. And of course, the irony is, and this is another sort of defeat for the United States strategically, is they had to remove the sanctions from Russian oil, although not that that really made a huge difference, but optically, from a political perspective, it's an embarrassment to have to say to the world, well, we're officially removing sanctions because we need Russian oil to flood the market as much as possible to make up for the fact that there's this shortfall of whatever it is, 10 to 15 million barrels of oil per day.
So, why do you think you mentioned the crude price not reacting the way we think it should at this point. And obviously that means a larger energy shock for the world. A, how tight are supplies right now? I know you kind of put a post on Twitter the other day trying to, let's say, clarify the validity that many gas stations don't have fuel, and many places like the UK don't have enough fuel? And B, why do you think the markets really haven't reacted yet?
Well, there's a few main points. Clearly, there was, if you look at when the war started on the 28th of February and when effectively oil, let's just deal with oil exports, that point would have stopped. There's a lot of oil all, you know, ocean bound already. By all accounts, the last oil has arrived in Rotterdam a few days ago. So the argument, therefore, is for now, you know, things are okay because the tightness in supply is not going to be felt to the degree it's going to be in the future, when in the coming weeks, and depending on how long the war lasts, potentially months and longer, there is going to be limited supply, or in some cases at times no supply. Mm-hmm. That's when you're really going to start feeling the pinch with regards to the real world, where you need oil. And you know, you can, the market manipulation doesn't apply in the real world. So the logistics of getting that oil wherever it needs to go is going to start being seriously impacted going forward, and for however long the war lasts. And the longer it lasts, the bigger the impact's going to be. And then we start having a situation where there's going to be a mad scramble to get your hands on whatever oil you can anywhere in the world, and then it becomes a case of who's prepared to pay the most to get it. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the financialization side, rather like every other market in the world of financialization, is clearly manipulated. Some of it is manipulated based on statements coming out from the Trump administration that markets are reacting to it, but there is a general desire to suppress the price and not allow it to move sort of north of 100, then heading towards 120, etc. I think if you had a properly functioning market, it would certainly be considerably higher, because there's definitely indications that oil's changing hands in the real world, in parts of the world, at $130-$140 a barrel. Now, obviously, we have to take into account how much seaborne oil is been circulating around the world since the start of the war, but when that ceases to be the case. And obviously there was certain amounts of oil going through the pipeline that traverses Saudi Arabia and goes out through the Red Sea. There's a lot of claims that that may start to be a problem, particularly if the Houthis prevent that energy being supplied, but on the same basis that the Iranians have sort of throttled to some extent, or a significant extent, oil, and for that matter, gas coming out of the Strait of Hormuz. So it'll be interesting in the coming weeks to what extent that's going to impact the price. But clearly there's also manipulation, price manipulation in terms of, Brent and US crude, irrefutably. But there comes a point with regards to trying to price manipulate oil where it's not like manipulating the price of gold and silver. At the end of the day, you have to sit there and say, well, if someone's buying oil, they're going to buy physical oil. They're not going to sit there and buy exposure to oil and then never take delivery of it. If you need oil, you need oil. It's the lifeblood of the world. With all due respect, I know there's industrial demand for silver, and it's very critical, but you can't put it in the same category as oil. You know, because the argument is without oil, you're never going to mine gold and silver. So, you know, it's one of those situations where it's a very different dynamic in terms of energy markets. So, therefore, there's going to come a point, and I think this is something that's going to be factoring into someone's thinking, at least in the Trump administration. If this war doesn't end soon, then there's going to be this huge dearth of oil globally, then that's likely to cause the price to significantly hike northwards. And whilst the US sits there, and particularly it's been a feature of the Trump administration to go, well, we'll just provide the world without all the energy they need, no problem. I mean, the United States doesn't have the capability to do that. So there comes a point when they're not going to be able to provide any more energy to anyone. And then the amount of energy circulating globally is going to be significantly reduced, and the demand's not going to disappear. It's not like the world's going to go into total darkness and we all just sit around with candles hoping for the best. This is not how the world operates. So I think we're probably in the next few weeks on the cusp of seeing some big changes in the price of oil, and therefore that starts to put pressure on the Trump administration to have this off-ramp and a way of obviously trying to influence the energy markets. And it's probably as much as anything why the Trump administration now has come up with this idea, well, if we can implement a blockade, but just blockade the Iranians, then we'll allow everyone else to export their energy, and that will then go a long way to alleviating the pressures that are coming very, very soon in, for example, the oil markets globally.
Well, Paul, if, let's say tomorrow, a ceasefire and a peace plan was actually agreed to, there were security guarantees, everything, do we not still have major shocks coming in the energy market, in the fertilizer market, in the food market, helium, sulfuric acid, all of these other things that really the entire supply chain relies upon? So if peace is agreed to tomorrow, do we not still face a major catastrophe because of the disruption of many of these critical pieces of the supply chain?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to what extent we can't quantify precisely, but the longer the war drags on, the bigger this problem is. And yeah, it's not just oil. And obviously Qatar shut down operations of its LNG facility, but also I think 20% of it was damaged in by the Iranians, and that they, by the Qataris' own admission, will take 3 to 5 years to repair. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're back to that point again. If the war drags on and the worst case scenario, the Iranians do start destroying critical energy infrastructure and desalination plants, then all bets are off. Then we're in a territory we can't even begin to comprehend the devastation that will ensue globally, not least in the Middle East itself. But coming back to your original point, yeah, if the war ends tomorrow, you know, we're going to have serious difficulties, because you're not going to immediately, like say, there's this magic tap where you switch everything on and energy starts flowing. It's going to take a number of months. Now, I can't, you know, speculate with any degree of confidence how long that takes. I mean, if you sat there and told me to devise a plan and how could we do this, then I would have an expectation based on the input that it should take this long. But knowing how the world operates and the inefficiencies, it's probably, you can double whatever figure we come up with. So you're talking a significant period of time, the order of a number of months at the very least. And therefore, in that time, how fragile are all, you know, not just Western economies, but other economies in the world. But because we're talking from the West, you know, Western perspective, not ignoring the rest of the world, but a lot of the audience will be in the West. Then the question is, how fragile are our economies already to the risk of massively hiked energy prices for the foreseeable future? Well, I think we are. Now, this is not a secret, just how fragile Western economies are, Western financial system is. So that is a huge problem in the making. And then there's all the derivatives that come out of oil. You make plastics, for example, and chemical production. And then you make the point about helium. And I put a YouTube clip out several weeks ago talking about how critical helium is, because it's utilized in semiconductor production. Fertilizer even more important, because significant amounts of global fertilizers come out of the Middle East via the Strait of Hormuz. If that doesn't happen, then, you know, and you know, in the Northern Hemisphere you have planting seasons. We can't magically turn the clock and back and say, oh well, let's just pretend it's planting season again. If we miss it, then we're going to significantly impact food production. And you know, I don't want to scare people witless, but we have to start to consider even in the Western world, the unthinkable that we will have potentially food shortages and very significant ones. And there are other commodities that come out of the Middle East as well. And we have to factor all this into our thinking, and absolutely ending the war today would not solve the problems tomorrow. And I know people are kind of think that there's this system where everything works just in time. Well, it does when everything's functioning and operating, but as soon as you throw a spanner in that works, then the just in time goes totally out the window, and just in time becomes maybe in a few months or maybe longer. And then there's all the other issue of supply chain problems and how it impacts the broader, you know, economies. And then you can start to have not only serious energy problems, serious problems with food production, but also then it starts to massively impact the financial system and economies. And given the fragility of them, then we could start to have this enormous crisis that engulfs us in all the critical aspects of not only how our economies work, but then we're going to see a situation where we have huge problems in the financial system. And of course, historically, in the last sort of 17, 18 years, the answer to all of that has been just print lots of money. Well, you can't print money to produce food that doesn't exist. You can't print money if you've got problems with energy supplies. And that doesn't resolve these kind of critical features of how, you know, our very existence depends on it. And I'm not trying to sound again sensationalistic, but if we can't heat and light and we can't feed ourselves properly, we're going to have huge problems. This is a statement of the obvious. So, you know, central banks can sit there and say, we'll just print lots of money, but yeah, you can give us all lots of money to buy what exactly? And then if you extrapolate this, but we're going to talk about the financial stuff, so maybe we'll park it. But in a broad sense, one of the obvious questions is if the war drags on, and then we start to reach a scenario where a loaf of bread costs $10, and then in 2 weeks it costs $12, what does that mean? And, you know, and then we start to enter an entirely different situation. And as unlikely as people might think that is, you can't rule it out if the war drags on, or if it escalates in a way that Iran does carry out its threats. And then, you know, we do have 400 million people in the Middle East homeless, and energy production, etc., is completely decimated.
Paul, you and I have talked about silver before, and, you know, we kind of just touched on the idea, if there's no energy, obviously we can't mine the precious metals. The whole world runs on these molecules still. So, you know, I've been reading that silver inventories are already low on the Shanghai Physical Exchange. There's supposedly a massive short position open there as well. Plus, large manufacturers could be trying to get ahead of supply constraints by buying forward a little bit. How much of those factors that I just mentioned are, do you think, over-sensationalized? Or is there a possibility that we are facing another silver short squeeze because of this as well?
Well, look, the issue is that there's several schools of thought with regards to silver. If you look historically, if you have a serious economic downturn, whether that is regionalized or global, and you know, let's just work on the basis that if the war continues and it, you know, we're going to have a serious impact on global economies, then the argument is, well, silver demand industrially is going to you know, diminish. To what extent is difficult to say, although the argument is, given that silver's in every semiconductor chip, well, how much would semiconductor production diminish? We can't quantify that precisely on a global basis, but there's an argument that suggests, well, therefore that's going to impact industrial demand, and therefore that will impact the silver price. Well, potentially, but you also have to factor in, and this is something that perhaps people aren't aware of, but obviously what we've seen in recent weeks were, and the silver prices is actually responded to whether there's a belief the war is going to end tomorrow, or the war's going to carry on, and it's kind of not, well, volatile to a certain extent. But while this is all going on, guess who's buying up every ounce of silver they can get their hands on? The Chinese. Because the argument is there's still a shortage. At some point, where however long this goes on for, the world's going to recover. There's going to be an enormous demand for silver. So if we can buy it for $70-odd an ounce, for argument's sake, as opposed to 120, which it was not that long ago, then they'll just keep buying. And therefore, they, if they keep doing this, and not exclusively, is going to create, you know, this ongoing physical shortages in the market that ultimately matters, and not the paper markets. So we have to kind of factor that into our thinking. The other thing, of course, is whilst we traditionally associate silver as being a, you know, industrial metal, there is this argument and crossover, certainly from a retail perspective, where silver becomes a monetary metal. Now, there are rumours that I don't think I can substantiate at this point in time that certain countries are buying silver effectively as a monetary metal, not as a metal that they need it for industrial purposes. But of course, they might well be just stockpiling it for that very reason, knowing in the future there is going to be shortages. But if, for argument's sake, we start to have a, you know, serious impact to the extent of where it really is badly affecting economies, and we start to sink into serious depression with all the inflation associated with it because of escalating oil prices. So, you know, can you have a stagflationary depression? Well, I guess you can, for argument's sake. Then the question starts to be, well, whilst traditionally when there is, you look at 2008, how it impacted gold and silver, when the after effects of that came in and we started to have the risk of a sovereign debt crisis in Europe going, you know, through to 2011, etc., then gold and silver responded accordingly. And therefore, the argument could be that then there's going to be more silver demand from a retail perspective as a way of trying to protect yourself, because we're starting to see another sort of shot to the heart for fiat currencies. Then you might start to see more demand from a retail perspective, which then also is going to put a squeeze in terms of silver supply and demand, you know, and how that pans out in the future. Now, we're somewhat speculating here. It's difficult to know precisely what will pan out, but I think there are things that people ought to think about in terms of how they perceive, you know, silver might move, and by extension, gold also, of course, but gold being more of a monetary metal, of course, or principally, then, you know, there's going to be inevitably, if there's serious problems in financial system and economies in a very dire way, then the move into gold, self-explanatory.
Well, and I think that extends the idea of the monetary metal slash financial problems. Gold very likely accounts for a good amount of that, especially considering that many of these strategic countries have already place themselves in a position to be able to be in a very handsome position, or at least a lot more stable position going into some type of a reset around the financial assets that they actually hold, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. It's one of those situations. And of course, the, you know, it, that clearly would in that sense be a positive and a big move into gold. But also, of course, we have the ongoing situation where if the war drags on, then, and we've already seen clear indications of nations and inside the Middle East who've been dumping US dollar denominated assets, dumping US treasury, simply because there's been a big scramble and a mad rush for cash. Well, that might continue, because if, for argument's sake, these Middle Eastern countries can't export oil and gas, and this drags on, then they're going to start suffering enormously internally with their own economy, their own fiscal situation, and that's going to only accelerate this dumping of treasuries and dollar-denominated assets. And it's worth noting that in historically, if you have these kind of events, geopolitical events, whatever, then there's normally a big move into the US dollar, US treasury complex. Well, what we've seen is the exact opposite. We've seen yields rising. There's been dumping of US treasuries. And it's not entirely a lack of confidence per se in and the ongoing de-dollarization is part of it, but also because countries have been dumping treasuries to try and stabilize their currencies. That, you know, Turkey's one very obvious example of that, but they've also been dumping gold to try and again raise cash. So we have to sort of factor those kind of developments as well into our thinking as to, but what's the big beneficiary of this is enormous amounts of buying of yuan denominated debt. The yields on the yuan continue to fall. And this is something that's deeply disturbing for the Americans, because this is not something they expected to happen, but it's something from our perspective we've been expecting to happen for a considerable period of time, and it has been ongoing, but it's now accelerating. And this not least is because the, you know, if you look at what's happened as a side issue, but a very important one of the Iran war, is all these Middle Eastern countries bought into the petrodollar on the basis the US would be there to protect them. Well, all these bases, albeit US bases in the Middle East, have largely been destroyed, and the US has offered no military protection to any of these countries. So they're all going, well, hang on a minute. So what's the deal? Well, all of a sudden they're going, well, you're not going to offer us any protection. So why do we want to keep our side of the bargain in buying up massive amounts of US treasuries? Maybe we need to look elsewhere. And the Chinese are very accommodating. And if you want to raise debt, well, here's the great thing. The yield's far cheaper on the 10-year in China than it is in terms of buying US dollar denominated debt. So again, there's a big incentive, particularly for these countries in the Middle East who are beginning to struggle and have problems, because contrary to conventional wisdom, I wouldn't call it a hand-to-mouth existence, but if these countries are not selling oil or not selling gas or other resources, then they're very, very quickly going to start to have major internal economic and financial problems. Mm-hmm. And with these countries, that is particular instability in that region. We just have to avoid that at all costs. Whatever people's perspectives are on the monarchies that run these countries, you just do not want to see that level of instability, because the question then becomes who's going to fill the vacuum. And we don't want undesirable elements filling that vacuum, and there is a huge risk and that could happen, and that would then cause far more problems in the region than anything the United States perceives Iran could potentially cause.
So, Paul, you know, obviously the risk to the financial markets is something that, you know, a lot of people are aware of and justifiably worried about. Where do you think this instability is going to start showing? You know, where do the cracks in the system start to show first?
Well, I mean, there's two aspects to this. There's the real world, the real economy, and then there's the financialization or the financial system. And yes, they're intertwined to some extent, but they're obviously very separate. And if we deal with the real world, right, if the, you know, we're back to, if we take the lesser of the evils and say the, you know, the war ends tomorrow and what we've said, then I think we're going to go through a very uncomfortable period. They'll probably be able to mitigate some of the problems. The question is what happens to European energy by winter time? Are they going to have sufficient in storage? And is that therefore going to have a big impact later on? And yes, clearly there is going to be an impact. But if the war drags on, and then we start to see where you can't suppress the oil price and the oil price skyrockets, then we're going to go into the realms of huge inflation because everything depends on the price of energy. And then if we start to see that, then what's left of, for example, Germany is a great example in Europe. They're suffering huge deindustrialization, not least because they don't have access to cheap energy as it was before the war started, because you know, Nord Stream was destroyed. The one pipeline that could be switched on won't be switched on for political and ideological reasons. But if then energy starts to be, well, it was about $60, $70 a barrel, and then becomes 100, 120, 150, then very rapidly we are going to see huge problems across all economies. But let's just focus on the West for now. So then we start to stray into the territory of saying, well, if we also have food shortages, which could, you know, manifest themselves pretty rapidly, then all of a sudden, you know, if we use the loaf of bread analogy, a loaf of bread costs suddenly $10 a loaf, or 10 euros, just for argument's sake. And then in a few weeks, it's $12 or $15. Then you're going to see a crisis of confidence in the currency. When it starts to affect people, where they're seeing food prices rise sharply on a weekly, monthly basis, and there's no let up in this, then people are going to start hoarding. People are going to, every time they get their hands on something, they're going to go, well, I better buy it now.
Yeah.
Because in a few weeks it might be more expensive. Then you're really straying into the territory of a crisis of confidence in the currency. That's when hyperinflation happens. I hear all these people talking about hyperinflation. It only happens when there's a crisis of confidence in the currency, not because inflation's at 15%. That's hyperinflation. No, not. It might be, but not necessarily. But if we stray into that territory, then we have got massive problems with the economy. Then you start to see enormous impact on people's livelihoods, their capability to feed themselves. Then, you know, we're going into the Northern Hemisphere into the summer, so we get a little bit of respite in some ways. But if this is dragging on into the winter, and then, you know, energy costs are skyrocketing, and there's food shortages, and then it starts to also impact the real economy, because that depends completely on energy, then massive unemployment. And then you start to really, really bite hard across the entire West. Then, you know, then the risk is, well, how are people going to react to this? And they're going to react very badly. And I had meetings recently with some officials and made these very points. You need to be aware of the fact, if this escalates out of control, then that's precisely what can happen. And what do you think the average person's going to respond? They're going to want you to solve something, and your attitude is going to be, well, just print lots of money. And we're back to the fact that printing money doesn't magically produce the very basic resources we as people need to function on a very basic level, including heating, lighting, feeding ourselves, etc. So that becomes a massive problem. Then the issue is, okay, what happens with the financial system? Well, by extension, it's totally overextended. You know, we've maxed out on debt. We've got huge problems in just about every sector. I mean, private credit's something I've been talking about for a long time. That's suddenly getting some traction, and I'm glad it is, because for me, that potentially could be arguably a kind of subprime crisis for 2026 or 2027, depending on when it really unravels. But it's a huge market that's not regulated properly, is trillions of dollars, and it's just the tip of an iceberg. Well, if you start to have massive impact on the financial system, and that's going to be tied in with the real economy as well, then and it's like a double whammy, and it all happens at the same time, as well as the shortages in potentially in energy and food and other critical resources. Then, you know, we're looking at a scenario that we haven't seen before. And I, at this point in time, based on conversations I've had, I don't think anyone's really taking this seriously enough. And I'm not trying to scare people, and I'm not prone to outbursts of of nonsense and hyping things to the point of stupidity and making these ridiculous statements. But this is something we have to consider. Countries and I have to consider this to be a possibility, and there needs to be coordinated action to say, well, if this the risk is that this does happen, what are we going to do to prevent that happening as much as possible? And then it comes back to the fact that the war has to end, but the war's not going to end on the basis of the United States telling Iran how it's going to end, because after 6 weeks we've seen that that's been an abysmal failure, and frankly it's not going to change. The Iranians' position isn't weakening, so therefore there has to be some cooler heads that are going to sit down and say, okay, as unpalatable as this is, as much as we're not very happy about Iran, whatever people's perspectives are, and we're just trying to be completely objective and look at it from the West's point of view, they're going to have to make some really tough choices, and that will include liaison with the Russians. That will include liaison with the Chinese, because the Chinese can do a hell of a lot to try and alleviate some of the problems. And there's going to, I wouldn't call it a Bretton Woods, but maybe we are on the cusp of something akin to that if this carries on, because it's going to need global solutions to a global problem. And I think the United States and Western countries are going to have to not sit there and imagine, oh, we're immune to this and it's not going to affect us, because it's going to affect everyone if this war carries on for X number of months and isn't ended today with problems that will ensue, as we said earlier, for a number of months going forward. If this is still going on in 6 months' time, for argument's sake, then we're going to be in for a world of pain that nobody wants to contemplate. And we have to avoid that at all costs.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you, and I don't know how avoidable this situation could have been. It seems like there's a history of, let's say, aggression towards Iran, and I think that, only blaming Trump as unhinged and as unpredictable as he might seem to some people, there's plenty of tapes going back that of plenty of American politicians always saying that Iran is this type of priority that needs to be attacked at some point. But this is also somewhat cyclical in a fourth turning type sense, and to think that this is only Trump's fault or that we wouldn't have had any of these pain points to go through, I think is somewhat misguided. But this is a situation that, at the end of an empire is going to happen, whether or how it ends up happening, is obviously different with different people involved. But that's why we have these discussions, to try to look at this from a far more 50,000 foot view and to do something about it rather than react to the situations that are unfolding in front of us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not a Trump problem per se. And in fact, it's worth mentioning, if you go back, this is the sort of weird paradox with this. If you go back to Trump 1.0, quite literally throughout the whole of his presidency, the Israelis wanted to go to war with Iran. And the Trump 1.0 said it's not happening. And if you go back, the same happened was went on during Obama. And even go back further than that in US administration. So yeah, there's been this ongoing risk of a confrontation or a war. But the sort of irony to all this is the United States, and this will work, there'll be people who will get really bent out of shape for me saying this, but the United States really didn't want to go to war with Iran. Yeah, it wants regime change. It doesn't want the current governmental structure in place. It wants a Western leader, and it wants to be able to manipulate the assets in all the massive oil and gas reserves. But also, Iran has enormous gold reserves that's not widely understood. So, there's a lot of reasons why the United States would like a change of leadership. That's irrefutable. But the United States has not been keen on going to war per se. And if you go back to the 12-day war last year, I mean, it's ironic that the Israelis approached the Americans and said, can you get the Iranians to agree to end the war? Because we're running out of interceptors. We cannot defend ourselves. And there was an agreement reached. And part of that agreement was the Americans pretending to bomb their nuclear facilities, which they didn't. And the Iranians got to pretend to bomb the U.S. Air base in Qatar, the biggest one in the region. And they all went home, and that was the end of that. And because the Americans could have escalated that and turned into war, they didn't want a war. And the argument is, and maybe history will prove this definitively, if you look at this time what happened, there was these discussions in Oman. The Omani foreign minister flew to the US and was saying, look, the Iranians are prepared to give you more than they were going to give you with the JCPOA, including a definitive statement they would never produce nuclear weapons, which wasn't part of the JCPOA when that came into existence. Now, subsequently, what happened by the following morning, the claim is that the Israelis started bombing Tehran, and the Americans went, well, the Iranians have said if this happens, they're going to start targeting us in the Middle East. So we better get in before they get us. And that's why they joined the war. Now, if that is indeed the case, and there's reason to believe it is, then the argument is they reluctantly entered this war. But of course, once you start entering a war and then the Iranians respond, then the Americans are going to respond. And now they're in this situation where they're trying to find a way of getting out of the war, but it's extremely difficult to do that. And it will surprise people me saying this, but I've always maintained the US doesn't want the Ayatollah and the IGRC having the influence they do in Iran, but they want regime change. They want, as I said, Western sympathetic government, and they want Iran on their side. And certainly not on the side of the so-called multipolar world and becoming this dominant kind of nation that the Americans and the Israelis fear will happen in the region. But that's, entirely different than saying, let's go to war. Because if you look about the prospect of actually going to war, prior to February the 28th, there was a lot of noises coming out of the Pentagon and obviously the CIA going, we cannot afford to go to war with them. And remember, there was supposed to be that time a few weeks previously where the Americans were going to have a preemptive strike, and they walked away and said, we're not doing it. By all accounts, the reason they did it is because they were told, this is not a decapitation strike if we go, and it will not succeed, it will fail. And they went, okay, we're not going to do it. Subsequently, they have done it and contradicted that assertion. But that assertion came from the Pentagon. It came from the CIA. So, again, this stacks up with this whole perspective that the US wants those certain objectives, but it definitely didn't want to go to war. Now it's stuck in a war, and it's got to find an off-ramp so it doesn't look like it's got to leave with its tail between its legs, because that's not only going to deeply damage Trump's midterm prospect, but it also makes the United States really, or frankly, become persona non grata in the Middle East, because all these countries are going, well, you can't protect anything, including your own assets. They were all destroyed. So that's an added dimension to this whole equation that and what I've just said and the evidence to support that assertion makes it something that, as unbelievable as it may seem to a number of people, it's actually factually correct. Mm-hmm.
Well, Paul, I'd like to kind of wrap this conversation up for today, to put a pin in it here. Is there anything that you want to leave listeners to think about in a, obviously very tumultuous and unpredictable time here?
I think we could talk another hour, but let's try and be try and distill it down. Look, the thing with this whole conflict is it has not just regional implications. It has global implications. It has implications where this war doesn't just affect the countries in the region or just affects Iran, because, you know, it's a major oil supplier. It's also gas and other, you know, commodities, etc. So it is going to impact the global perspective. To what degree ties in with everything we've discussed previously. So this is a massive geopolitical event that, you know, threatens to really end up with the United States persona non grata in the region. It threatens to change the whole emphasis of Israel's future in the region. Also, what's Iran's, you know, role going forward? How much is that going to change where it becomes a more dominant player? What happens to all these regional players like the Saudis? Is the governmental structure and the monarchies going to survive? There are questions that irrefutably are the case. Then if we extend it beyond that, you know, NATO partners and the United States are ever drifting apart, and this war's been another huge problem in that regard, in that relationship collapsing. NATO seems as though it's on its last legs and won't survive either. And then there's, you know, we're back to this thing of what happens in terms of economies, what happens with the financial system, given how weak Western economies, the financial system is. So it's this massive all-encompassing thing that affects every facet of every country in the world to varying degrees. Some, it will, like Russia, won't really affect them at all. But by and large, it's going to have a serious impact, including the United States, who can sit there and imagine it's not going to, but it most certainly will. And therefore, you know, it's one of those things you have to think of 30, 40 different things simultaneously. But what I would say is be extremely careful in terms of what people are saying. A lot of it's absolute nonsense. There's huge amounts of stories that are made up, and very sadly, one aspect of AI is the amount of fake images that are doing the rounds. So be extremely careful, but on a personal level, just start to think, well, if the worst case scenario happens, what am I going to need to do to protect myself? And I'm not trying to, you know, blow this out of proportion, but, you know, if it comes to the matter of hiked energy prices and massive energy shortages and food shortages, then you have to start thinking differently about your future and how you have to plan for it. And, you know, I've made this point, and I'll say very clearly, you know, I have a 10-month-old daughter. We've had to rethink our thoughts about what could the impact going to be. So we have to protect her and therefore by extension ourselves. So we've put measures in place to ensure that we have all the critical things she needs going forward for a considerable period of time, because we can't take the risk that you know, and be blasé and then act, you know, when the world blows up, because as we said earlier, it's too little too late. But, you know, be measured about it, how you deal with the problem, how you think about it, but don't equally be dismissive and imagine it's not going to be a problem. We have to hope it doesn't. And, you know, maybe in a few weeks we're going to go, well, yeah, we've got a difficult period, but we'll get through this. Okay, that doesn't sort of negate the broader problems that exist in the West with economies, financial system, all the geopolitical downturn, because the Western Empire is still going away, whether irrespective, this is just an accelerant that could cause massive problems, as we've just alluded to. So just have a balanced perspective on this, but don't be blasé and dismissive of the potential for very serious problems, because whilst it's not being discussed publicly, at least on a private level, there is some acknowledgement of it. But I think increasingly there is going to, if this war carries on, where Western countries, and not exclusively, are going to start going, hang on a minute, we're going to have to start taking a far more serious perspective on this, because the idea that this is just a small little blip and a transient problem is not going to be the case. And of course, if the war drags on for many more months, and as unlikely as people might want to believe that's the case, well, you know, I'm not making direct comparisons, but look at the Ukraine war. I mean, I have to go from my own perspective. The only thing that surprised me about it is it's still going on 4 years later, 4 years and nearly 2 months. I didn't expect it to continue that long. So, and whilst there's an argument that things are very different and the stakes are much higher in some senses with regards to Iran and the Middle East because of all the reasons we've stated, don't, you know, be dismissive that there isn't a risk this war could carry on for far longer than we perceive it to be. And then all the things we've discussed becomes a very, very unpalatable, but unfortunately a reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, as always, I want to thank you for a very thorough analysis of all of these different things. If anybody wants to see more of your work, that's all available on X at the Serious Report, seriousreport.com, and of course your Substack, theseriousreport.substack.com. Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and thanks for asking. It's always great when we get together.
Absolutely.